Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 5th of March. The United States has confirmed it has paused its intelligence sharing with Ukraine on the eve of an emergency EU summit on security. We'll learn what Europe is thinking about its own defence from an EU defence minister, hear about the impact the continued fighting in Ukraine is having on Ukrainian soldiers and on the families of Russians who have died in the conflict. Also, the United States confirms it's in direct talks with Hamas over the release of hostages. The Justice Secretary distances herself from some new sentencing guidelines and the curious appeal of management sims. Why do people come home from one job and play a game that simulates doing another? Another day, another shock to the system for Western nations used to taking American security guarantees for granted. When EU leaders meet for an emergency security summit in Brussels tomorrow, it will be in the knowledge that the United States hasn't just paused shipments of military aid to Ukraine, but the sharing of at least some intelligence with a country that's been relying on Washington to hold off Russia's military assault. Well, the White House has said that the aid and the intelligence could resume if there is progress towards US-led peace talks, and there have been encouraging noises today from officials around President Trump and from President Zelensky as well, but as of yet, no commitment. Well, the new reality of this overtly transactional US foreign policy has led European leaders to search for pithy phrases to characterise the moment. The incoming German Chancellor Friedrich Merz has called it 5 minutes to midnight for Europe, and he's made an unprecedented pledge to loosen Germany's strict borrowing rules to boost defence spending. And tonight, in a televised address to the French nation from the Élysée Palace, President Macron outlined plans for a specifically European approach to Ukraine.
Mais compte tenu de l'évolution des menaces, de cette accélération que je viens de décrire,
as soon as next week, we will gather in Paris the army chiefs who will take responsibility for this matter. And so, this is a plan for a solid, lasting, verifiable peace, which we have prepared with the Ukrainians and several European partners, and which I defended in the United States 2 weeks ago and across Europe. And I would like to believe that the United States will stay by our side. But we have to be ready if this isn't the case.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is an expert on European and transatlantic foreign and security policy with the Brookings Institution, a think tank in Washington. What does she think the Europeans should be focusing on at tomorrow's summit?
They need to be focusing on putting a serious message out to Ukraine, to Russia, to China, and to the United States, that the burden shifting is happening, and it's happening now, not just in 10 years. The rest, to be honest, is details, but I will say that I am seeing movement in Brussels, in Paris, and in Berlin of the kind that I haven't seen in 30 years of watching this space.
Specifically, you're looking at things like what the incoming German Chancellor talking about, well, you know, removing the limits on what can be borrowed to spend on military outgoing, for example.
Indeed. I mean, look, I think any listener who now rolls his or her eyes and says, you know, we've been lecturing, haranguing, begging you for decades to do more about European defence, the Germans to increase their defence spending, I would just simply say guilty as charged. That's true, but it's somewhat irrelevant to the present situation, because you are actually seeing the French, the Germans, and the European Commission do things that they never thought they would be doing, and in fact didn't think they'd be doing until about a week ago.
And they are doing this because of what Donald Trump has done and what his administration is doing. It's proving, then, in that sense, effective.
Yes. You know, I ended a previous sort of column of mine with a jokey point that Trump might end up being the great unifier of Europe. And I get the distinct sense that that is exactly what is happening this week. That Oval Office conference, televised Oval Office conference with Zelensky last Friday, put a genuine fear into European capitals. What we're seeing is the result of that. I mean, let me just remind you that on my own country, Germany, the conservative incoming chancellor campaigned on his and his party's opposition to greater national debt, right? And he is now, to the dismay and anger and frustration of the future opposition parties, remember we still have a caretaker government, to their dismay is now throwing all of that overboard and mobilizing up to €1 trillion, which, you know, by any standards is historical, in order to increase German defense spending and improve German infrastructure. And the latter is not just, you know, bus stations in the countryside. It's relevant to the defense of Europe in as much as Germany, simply because of its location, is the transportation hub for any military movements in Europe.
You talk about European unity. There are, though, countries, notably Hungary, which Indeed. Are very much on a different page here. Can Europe be united when it comes to specifically the war in Ukraine, specifically to countering a threat from Russia?
Well, it's not just the Hungarians.
Slovakia as well.
So Slovakia with Robert Fico, exactly. But I would just say that there have been massive street protests in Slovakia against the government, and there is a real homegrown opposition against Viktor Orban in Hungary as well. So even those, you know, those heads of government are not entirely safe in their own countries against political opposition. But what's somewhat more relevant at this point is that I think it's fair to say that other European leaders are sick and tired of a form of opposition that is happy to take and to rake in European funds, and who continually undermine European cohesion and foreign and security policy. I think that the other Europeans in this situation of crisis have reached the end of their tether.
Constanze Stelzenmüller from the Brookings Institution. Well, Latvia is one of the EU and NATO countries that's already spending more than 3% of its GDP on defence. And ahead of tomorrow's EU summit, I've been speaking to Latvia's Defence Minister, Andris Spruds. I asked him how he felt about this moment for European security.
It's time to take more responsibility in European hands. It's time to support Ukraine more extensively. So we have to be ambitious in European Council. So we have to move forward with defense spending, which demonstrates both the political will and demonstrates also the understanding of challenging global situation.
Of course, there's been a full-scale war in Ukraine for more than 3 years now. What's changed has changed in Washington, isn't it? How do you view the changes in Washington and what they mean for European security?
The principles remain the same. We must support Ukraine. What happens in Ukraine have wider implications for global security. And with Donald Trump becoming a president, this has also re-emphasized some of the focuses, namely that European countries must invest more in the security and stability in its neighborhood and its own security and defense.
How secure does Latvia feel? I ask in the context of what's happened in the last day or two with America stopping military aid to Ukraine and also intelligence sharing as a way to get President Zelensky to come back to the negotiating table.
Well, we recognize some changes, some new developments in global politics. So that's why, of course, society keenly also follows what happens and what are the new developments. At the same time, there is understanding that let's not over-dramatize and let's not over-focus on every nuance and every emphasis in a specific speech. So,
but with all respect, this is not a speech. This is, we're talking about stopping of aid, stopping of intelligence. That's very concrete, isn't it?
Well, we're speaking about a postponing and pausing on specific supplies and support. It is unfortunate to postpone support for a nation which fights for its freedom. But at the same time, let's also remember that, first of all, it's about Ukraine's people and their resilience and decisions.
And who will protect the peace? Now, the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the French President Emmanuel Macron are talking about a coalition of the willing. Is that something that Latvian troops would be prepared to be part of?
Latvia would consider being part of the coalition, but provided we understand fully what are the parameters of such mission and provided that we, of course, also protect our own regional and national security in the Baltic region.
And would you need some kind of what Britain is calling a backstop from America in order to commit troops to some future peacekeeping mission?
It's unchanged. We believe and we are confident the United States have been, is, and will be strategic ally of NATO partners, of NATO nations, and also of Latvia.
So no question in Latvia about whether or not you can rely on Article 5 of NATO, whether or not America would come to your defense if you were attacked by Russia or indeed any other country.
In general terms, no. There is understanding that NATO is alive and strong. And again, if we see also the some of the statements and policies, then yes, unfortunate meeting with or between U.S. and Ukrainian leaders. But same time, when discussions go on military mutual assistance and alliance within NATO format, then I've heard only the statements that actually NATO must be stronger, NATO must be more lethal, NATO must have the fair burden sharing among the countries, exactly to become even more lethal and more powerful.
What about European solidarity when it comes to Ukraine? Within the European Union, within NATO, you've got countries like Hungary, Slovakia, who essentially are vetoing any moves that appear to be against Russia, it would seem.
Well, there are two parts. One is, of course, the European Union is about 27 countries, and there is diversity of perspectives. Even taking into account some of the diversity, the joint position on sanctions, sometimes it takes some time to agree, but we already see 16 rounds of sanctions. We see the permanent flow of weaponry and support and financial support also by EU to Ukraine. So on the fundamental issues, at the very end, there is a consensus. But yes, some of the countries, and I would define very specifically Hungary, has taken a stance which can be assessed critically also from partners, including Latvia.
And that was Latvia's Defence Minister Andris Spruds. Coming up later on in the programme, we'll hear from a Ukrainian who publicly deserted in order to highlight the pressures facing soldiers on the front line.
I've been fighting as a soldier for 5 years, and I've spoken publicly and loudly about the need to be very precise about how long a soldier should serve. And we've been talking about these things, me, lots of representatives of civil society, but we've never been heard.
Full interview later on. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has publicly distanced herself from parts of the new sentencing guidelines produced by the Sentencing Council. The updated guidelines from the independent body, which is sponsored by the Ministry of Justice, say that a defendant's faith and ethnicity, amongst other things, should be considered when deciding whether to send them to prison. Shabana Mahmood has posted on X that this did not represent her views or those of the government, and she said she would be writing to the council to recommend reversing them. Well, we can speak now to Mark Day, who's Deputy Director at the Prison Reform Trust. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening.
First of all, this dispute seems to be about how what are called pre-sentencing reports are used in determining sentence for people who've committed crimes. What exactly are they and when are they used?
Yes, well, a pre-sentence report is a report that can be requested by the judge from probation or from the youth offending team. And it's simply a request for information. So this could be information about the offender's background, offending history, and indeed a recommendation for a sentence that might be passed, taking into account those factors. But it is only a request for information, and the decision on the sentence that is passed remains that of the court. And indeed, it is the default that if anyone is being considered for a custodial or community sentence, then the court ought to be requesting and considering a pre-sentence report unless it considers it unnecessary. So it seems to me that this current dispute is a bit of a storm in a teacup.
Well, tell us about why these guidelines have been updated. Why has this come to the fore?
Well, what the guidelines were produced after a very careful consultation involving a number of different bodies, including sentences, including charities, and have actually been widely welcomed as an improvement upon the guidelines that existed before. And what the guidance around PSRs has done is brought together the existing guidance, but introduced some new additional parts, which are important and will help sentences in coming to a more informed sentencing decision and then hopefully a more effective disposal.
But to be clear, this question of ethnicity and faith and culture, that is new, is it?
It's not new in the sense that it has always been a factor that has been on the mind of sentences, and in this guideline, it's simply reflecting the fact that if we look at outcomes from sentencing, there is disproportionality. So we know already that if you are from a minority ethnic background, you are more likely to receive a custodial sentence for an equivalent offence, particularly for certain types of offences such as drug offences, than you would if you were white. So there is very good reasons why in guidelines you would want to say that information needs to be had about someone's background in order to inform the sentencing decision.
So what do you make then of the Justice Secretary's response and her call for this to be reversed?
Well, I'm not quite sure what will be requested, because, as I said, the guideline is already pretty careful in what it states, in that it states that anyone being considered for a community or custodial sentence, the court ought to be considering requesting a PSR unless it doesn't consider it necessary. It then goes on to list particular cohorts where it would normally be important to request a PSR. Someone from an ethnic minority background is there, but also somebody who was pregnant or someone who is a sole or primary carer of dependent relatives. Now, there are different reasons why you would want to request a PSR in relation to those groups, but there are very good reasons for needing to. I'm not quite sure what the Secretary of State will be requesting the Council to do.
Mark, many thanks. Mark Day, Deputy Director at the Prison Reform Trust.
Prehistory. Time before time knew what time it was. Here we have a primitive computer. So ancient, so rudimentary, we think it could be at least 3 years old.
A trailer there for Two Point Museum. It's a new computer game that's getting rave reviews. It's part of a genre of games called Management Sims, whose players don't drive fast cars or shoot enemies. They manage, or at least simulate managing, institutions like museums or hospitals or farms. The Britons who came up with Two Point Museum were behind earlier successes Theme Hospital and Theme Aquarium. So, what is the appeal of this sort of game? Ellie Gibson's a computer games journalist, and she even holds a world record for playing a game.
Well, I think for people who don't play games, it can be a bit confusing, can't it? Because often when we think of video games, we think they let us do exciting things that we can't do normally, right? So you can be a space marine or a Viking, or you can be an archaeologist with big knockers going around jumping off tombs. And it's all very exciting. But these games, these simulator games, let you try out a sort of day-to-day job that you wouldn't perhaps get to do in real life, or perhaps you could do, but you haven't bothered with the training or whatever it is. Or sometimes quite mundane tasks. There's something really satisfying, I find, about a lot of these games.
And what is it then about, perhaps if you're going out and doing a job, coming home in the evening and doing this alternative job? What is it, do you think, that appeals?
Well, I think if you've got a job that's quite stressful, you know, perhaps if you're like a brain surgeon or something, maybe it's lovely to come home and just run a supermarket. I mean, I don't know if you know this. I don't like to talk about it, Jamie, but I am actually the world record holder for the longest time playing Power Wash Simulator.
I'd heard a rumour, yes.
You'd heard that. Oh, strange. I'd like to keep it quiet. But I like that game because it's very soothing. It's very calming. It's just there's no sort of whizzy sound effects like you get in a lot of games these days. There's no murder. You don't have to go around collecting things and scoring points. It's just you and the rush of the water. And perhaps now and again, you might change your nozzle or pick a new pair of rubber gloves. But that's all the challenge. At the end of a busy day with work and kids and all the rest of it, that's all I want to relax of an evening.
And you enjoy these sim games, do you? Which ones do you particularly like?
Well, I love Power Simulator, obviously. I quite like the cooking games. I like games where you are working in like a sort of high pressure cafe situation. I really love a game called Airplane Chefs, because when I was little, I wanted to be an air hostess if I wasn't a video games journalist. I think I took the wrong path still, to be honest. But in this game, you are on an airplane and you've got to serve all the customers their little trays of food, and you've got to heat them up, and you've got to make the drinks, and you've got to get the tea and coffee out on time and empty the trash. And it's sort of stressful, but when you finish a level and all the customers give you little smiley faces, there's just something really, really satisfying about that and really enjoyable.
Ah, so there's a bit of wish fulfillment. There's also, I guess, a bit of getting the kind of feedback you'd like in real life.
I think there's that, and there's different kinds of simulators. You know, there are simulators that are very serious, like the flight simulators and stuff. It's all incredibly realistic, and you get to experience what it's like to be a commercial airline pilot. It's not something that really appeals to me. I did have a go of Lawnmower Simulator as well. Not really for me, but it's fun, you know.
Power washing rather than mowing the lawn. But what?
Yeah.
Who is making these? What kind of companies are we talking about here?
Well, there's all sorts of different companies. Obviously, there's big companies like Microsoft, I think, still make Flight Simulator, and that does really well. And the smaller games on the phones, they're often sort of smaller companies, obviously. And then there's quite a lot of simulator games that are being made by very small teams. So I play one of those called Supermarket Simulator, which is really a terrible game where you run a very badly drawn supermarket and serve a lot of very similar looking poorly animated people. There's not even much games. So I think at one point I was just selling mustard because I worked out that was the best way to make a profit. So it just became a mustard shop. So not sort of very deep, these games, but I quite like them as a sort of curio, as a sort of interesting little toy to play with. But
is there a more serious side to them? And could some of these, the more sophisticated ones, actually teach you management skills?
I mean, how hard could it be, really? Do you know what I mean? I've played Theme Hospital, and I think I could save the NHS, quite honestly. I think we'll get cut some corners, get more beds in. I think it looks easy.
Video games journalist Ellie Gibson there. Now, it seems the Trump administration has broken with another long-standing norm and held direct talks with Hamas. Since Hamas is designated as a terrorist group, all American contacts with the group have traditionally been through third parties. But with at least one US citizen among the hostages still being held in Gaza, Donald Trump's nominee as special envoy for hostage matters has reportedly held face-to-face talks with Hamas in Qatar. There was certainly no denial of that from the White House press secretary Caroline Levitt when she was asked about it at her regular briefing.
When it comes to the negotiations that you're referring to, first of all, the special envoy who's engaged in those negotiations does have the authority to talk to anyone. Israel was consulted on this matter. And look, dialogue and talking to people around the world to do what's in the best interest of the American people is something that the president has proven is what he believes is a good faith effort to do what's right for the American people.
Let's speak to our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, who's in Jerusalem. And beyond the fact they've happened, Paul, do we know anything more?
Well, not a great deal. Two direct meetings between Hamas and Adam Bola, preceded by several communications, we are told, by a senior Hamas official, who incidentally, by the way, said that there was actually a meeting with an official from the previous Biden administration in April last year, just a one-off meeting which didn't go anywhere, but also was about discussing hostages. So this is not a completely unprecedented moment. The Israelis don't seem particularly keen on this. There was a very, very terse statement from the Prime Minister's office simply saying Israel has expressed to the United States its position regarding direct talks with Hamas. Now, if this was a move by the Americans to try and jog the negotiations forward on the next stage of the Gaza ceasefire deal, it is a little hard to square it with a tweet from Donald Trump, which I've just seen in the last 10 minutes or so, in which, in typically loud language, he tells Hamas to release all hostages now, not later, and immediately return all dead bodies, or it is over. This is your last warning for the leadership. Now is the time to leave Gaza while you still have a chance. So what to make of that? put beside this sort of negotiations behind the scenes to secure the release of American hostages, it's a little hard to tell.
Yeah, and what do we know about the remaining hostages?
Well, we're talking about one American hostage and a dual citizen, 20-year-old soldier, Idan Alexander. He is thought to be the last living dual national held in Gaza, along with four other US citizens who are presumed to be dead. So presumably the negotiations are about trying to get them out. Now, we've known since late last year when Donald Trump appointed Adam Bola that he would do everything in his power to try and get US hostages out. But those contacts clearly haven't resulted in any progress so far. And Hamas are not giving any indication that we can see that a deal is imminent.
Paul, many thanks. Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, in Jerusalem. We're going to return now to the war in Ukraine and hear about the experiences of the people doing the fighting and their families. In a few moments, we're going to be hearing from a Ukrainian soldier who deserted on a point of principle, but who is now back on the front line. First, though, the economics of taking part in what President Putin calls his special military operation. Those Russians who sign up to fight in Ukraine earn big money in salaries and bonuses. But the Kremlin is even more generous to the families of the fallen. They receive the equivalent of around £100,000 in compensation. That's a life-changing amount in the poorer provinces where most recruits come from. The BBC's Arseniy Sokolov has been speaking to relatives of dead Russian soldiers, and he sent this report.
Andrei Nazarenko was 21 when he was killed fighting for Russia in Ukraine. At his old school in small town in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains of southern Russia, they solemnly unveiled a desk in his memory.
Nazarenko Andrei Andreevich родился 3 июня 2000 года.
He was a qualified chef, and when he called his mother Oksana from the front, he talked of using those skills when he got back.
He used to say, "Mom, let's open a cafe together. It'll be great."
Now, though she's still grieving bitterly, Oksana's fulfilled his dream without him. She's opened a cozy little restaurant in his memory.
We do lots of different cuisines, European, Caucasian, a bit of Japanese, like sushi. And my signature dish? Well, I do lagman.
A rich noodle dish with meat, vegetables and spices. The business employs several people. Oksana couldn't have started it without the compensation money from the state. The average payout is about 14 million rubles. That's nearly 160,000 US dollars. All over Russia, families of the fallen are using the money to buy property and rise up the social ladder. Economist Vladislav Anaziemtsev calls it deathonomics.
If someone signs up to the army at the age of 35 from not the most wealthy Russian regions, gets the regional payment for the signature of the contract, serves there 6 to 8 months and is killed, and all the compensations are paid to his family, it would be definitely bigger sum of money than he could earn till the end of his active life at the age of 65.
You could buy a whole village on the proceeds from one man's death.
That's lawyer and human rights defender Nadezhda Nizovkina, speaking from Buryatia on the Mongolian border. It's a poor, remote region that's provided a disproportionately high number of men to fight and die in Ukraine. But she says the newly acquired compensation money isn't always very visible.
Many people now are scared to flaunt their wealth, because showing you got rich on spilled blood, it means you or your relative didn't sign up out of high moral principles. The big recruiting posters don't mention money. They just say stand up and defend the motherland as a selfless gesture.
The Kremlin is determined that those who return alive from the front line will be treated as heroes. Vladimir Putin has even launched a scheme to fast-track selected veterans into leadership positions in local administration and businesses.
Подлинная, настоящая элита – это все, кто служит России.
The real elite, he says, are those who serve Russia, loyal workers and warriors.
It's still unclear whether that project will work. Existing local elites often resist admitting newcomers, but compensation payments have certainly catapulted a huge number of Russian families into a higher social class. If, according to rough but informed estimates, 150,000 Russian soldiers have died in Ukraine, and if each of their families has actually received what they're due, that would mean the state has spent the equivalent of more than 2% of federal expenditure on such payouts over the past 3 years. Andrei's mother, Oksana, hasn't received her full payout yet. Like many other bereaved single mothers, she's battling her ex-husband in court over who gets what share. But her new business, paid for with the Kremlin's compensation, has given her some comfort over the loss of her son.
And every night when I go to bed, I talk to Andrei. I say, I opened the restaurant just like you wanted. And if you were still here, I know you'd be helping me.
And that was the BBC's Arseniy Sokolov reporting. Let's turn to Ukraine now, where the problem of manpower 3 years into the full-scale invasion by Russia was one of the issues raised by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance during last week's heated Oval Office meeting with President Zelensky. The Ukrainians have been having trouble finding enough soldiers to fight on the front line, and that has led to new initiatives, from the voluntary recruitment of 18 to 24-year-olds to suggestions that all under-25s could be conscripted. 24-year-old Serhiy Gnezdilov volunteered for the Ukrainian army when he was 19, and he expected to serve in it for 3 years. But the Russian invasion meant his service became open-ended. Like many Ukrainian soldiers, he complained that this was leading to exhaustion and burnout. Unlike others, he did that publicly in a blog, and then, by deserting, he went AWOL to prove a point. He was detained last October and held in a military prison, but he was released under an amnesty for first-time offenders. He's now back on the eastern front lines, fighting near Donetsk. And from there, we discuss the recruitment problem, his actions. But first, given this week's developments, does he think Ukraine can cope without US military aid?
The question is, do we have a choice? We need to do everything possible to cope. And I'm just a bit surprised that sometimes our foreign friends, allies, don't really understand that we actually weren't given a choice by Russia other than to carry on. Because if we don't continue fighting, then we're going to have another Bucha or Mariupol or other horrifying stories like that. It's going to be tough, but I'm certain that we will find the resources to carry on to defend our people, and we will definitely find a solution to this situation.
Well, let's turn to your story, Serhiy. You are back on the front line, but you were not there for some time. Tell us how you came to leave the army, because you joined it in 2019, didn't you? You fought for many years, but you did decide to leave the army without permission in September. What led to that decision?
Я, по-перше, дуже вдячний BBC за увагу до моєї історії і за те, що ви...
I'm very grateful to the BBC for following my story. I've been fighting as a soldier for 5 years. I'm also the founder of a festival and the People's Initiative. That's another project I'm involved in. I've also hosted a show on one of the biggest media platforms in Ukraine. And I've spoken publicly and loudly about the need to be very precise about how long a soldier should serve and how their service should be timed and have a very distinct beginning and end. And also, I've been advocating for what I call the doctrine of war, that everyone has to fight. And we've been talking about these things, me, the other NGOs, lots of representatives of civil society, but we've never been heard. And given that, I made a decision to draw more attention to this issue by publicly going AWOL, because the problem has reached a catastrophic scale.
And that decision to go AWOL led to you being detained for several months. What was that experience like?
It was an interesting experience. It helped me understand, firstly, what it felt like being behind bars. It was a strange yet valuable experience. I got to read a lot. I talked a lot to my friends who visited me, and I came to lots of conclusions while there.
What sort of conclusions?
Напевно, я б більше і детальніше і глибше говорив би про це на внутрішньому.
The most important message is that freedom is vital and you have to fight for it. And my NGO, the People's Initiative, will continue fighting for specific defined terms of military service. And we're soon going to launch a legal helpline for Ukrainian service personnel.
Has your time being detained, has it made a difference? Do you think what you did made a difference?
Абсолютно вірно, тому що про це очевидно почали говорити.
Absolutely, I believe that it did make a difference. People started talking about this issue. They stopped ignoring the problem. And now we have a promise from a parliamentary committee that they will make some legislative changes in May. That's what they've promised us. And it's very sad that the war has been going on for 3 years, and we could have made this change at the very beginning. And for 3 years, it's been damaging the state.
Now, the act that you carried out, the way you decided to show what needed to be done, namely to desert, to go AWOL, it wasn't welcomed by quite a lot of your comrades. Can you understand why some people thought it was wrong to do what you did?
Звісно ж, ні, я абсолютно не можу зрозуміти такої точки зору. Я не раз.
I certainly do not and cannot understand this, and I've said it many times. Some of us are at the front line and have been fighting for a long time, while many others are ignoring their responsibilities under the Constitution. It's their right to agree or disagree, but most of the hatred that was aimed at me was not constructive or factual.
Now, you're back on the front line, and this is because you were released, because this was your first offence. What has it been like since you've returned? What kind of reaction have you had from your fellow soldiers?
Ну, це люди, з якими я служив тривалий час. Дехто був в такій ситуації.
The people that I came back to, these are the people I was fighting with before, and some of them actually were in the same situation as I was. But there were no really fervent reactions. Everybody understands that people fighting at the front get tired. Now I'm back fighting once again with the unit that I left, and overall, there's been no big issues at all. What's more, we've been promoting bringing those who've deserted back into the army, and furthermore, at the same time, when I publicly went AWOL, according to official statistics, there were 80,000 cases of military personnel going AWOL.
The Ukrainian soldier Serhiy Gnezdilov. Just time for our closing headline. In a television address to his nation, the French President Emmanuel Macron has warned that European countries must prepare for a big increase in spending on defence. EU leaders are gathering for an extraordinary summit in Brussels tomorrow. That is The World Tonight. I'm James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.